and the Annie E. Casey Foundation.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Coming up today, we're going to hear Florida This Week from this past Friday, a TV program that airs on WEDU that discusses state and local politics. We'll hear that coming up. And there was a military exchange between Israel and Iranian forces over the weekend, and that raises a question about whether or not Iran and Israel are heading toward war. It could have huge implications for the U.S. So later on in the program, we're going to talk about U.S. relations with Iran. But first, Florida This Week. And just to mention, too, that WMNF's fund drive was supposed to be underway right now. And it turns out that our phone system crashed on Friday morning. So we have suspended the fund drive. It's going to restart this afternoon at 2 o'clock. But we hope that in the interim, as you're listening to these programs here on WMNF, that you'll contribute to your favorite program. It could have been the morning show this morning. It could have been Democracy Now! It could have been the Sustainable Living program, maybe Radioactivity, maybe Sean Canan's Midpoint program, maybe Executive Session. But please make your contribution online at WMNF.org. That's a secure website that we operate, and we will take your donations. And every donation that we receive between now and 2 o'clock will shorten the length of the fund drive. So please make your contribution now. Even though we're not asking every 5 or 10 minutes for your donation, it's still important that we hear from you. So please contribute. Let us know what your favorite programs are. Go to WMNF.org. Look for the tip jar and make a contribution and help us shorten the drive that restarts this afternoon at 2 o'clock. Here is Florida This Week from this past Friday night. Coming up next, an election this Tuesday could give us an insight about how voters in Central Florida think about President Trump. The state's teachers union goes after Florida's House Speaker. So-called free speech zones on Florida campuses may be outlawed. And how did a small one-person company get a FEMA contract to deliver 30 million meals to Puerto Rico and then fail to deliver? Political Insights next on Florida This Week.
From the WEDU studios, this is Florida This Week. And now, moderator Rob Lori.
Welcome back. This week, our panelists are April Schiff is a political consultant and a Republican. Brendan McLaughlin is an independent journalist. Susan McGrath is the chair of the Pinellas County Democratic Party. And Allison Graves is a writer for PolitiFact Florida. It's so great to have you here. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Well, this coming Tuesday, there will be a test of how strong the pro and anti-Trump feelings are here in Central Florida. In a special election for the State House District 72 seat in Sarasota, Democrat Margaret Good is running against Republican James Buchanan. Libertarian Allison Foxall is also in the race. Donald Trump won the district by 4.4% during the 2016 presidential election. But since then, around the country, Democrats have been winning many seats formerly held by Republicans. Prominent national Democrats, including former Vice President Joe Biden, have endorsed Good. Sunday afternoon, Trump's former campaign manager is expected to endorse Buchanan, who is the son of Congressman Vern Buchanan, at a rally at the airport. So, Susan, with the national endorsements on both sides, national Republicans, national Democrats, this is a pretty high-profile race. The country's watching it. How is Good doing when it comes to fundraising and volunteers?
So Margaret's doing exceptional. You know, on any given year, on any other occasion, this would be a race where Democrats would have a low bar, would have a low opportunity to be able to pick up the seat. But that's not what we're seeing nowadays right away. Margaret has strong fundraising in her last reporting period. She outraised Buchanan by 2-1. She has more than 22,000 individual donors. There's a lot of excitement. We see that turnout for this race in District 72 exceeds any special election since 2014 when there was a congressional special election. So people are paying attention.
All right. So April, this weekend, Corey Lewandowski is going to be there at the airport in Sarasota. The national party's thinking about this. President Trump has got to be thinking about this race to some extent.
I don't know if Trump's thinking about this particular race. It's a special election, no matter what, is going to be lost or won by turnout. So the candidate who pushes their voters to the polls will be successful. Nothing else really matters at the end of the day, because special elections don't typically get a lot of voters. What we're seeing this year, for some reason, first off, we have a lot more special elections than we've had because we've had a lot more resignations than you've seen in recent history. And this particular race right now is polling pretty much neck and neck. So there is a whole lot of focus going into turnout and returning the mail ballots and early voting and that sort of thing. But both candidates have raised a significant amount of money, actually, for this type of a race, and they both have just about the same amount left on hand to spend. Buchanan a little bit more than Good, but it's also, Sarasota is historically a Republican leaning county. This is definitely a Republican dominated district, so it's really the Republicans to lose. They have to get their people to the polls,
and that's why Democrats want to beat Buchanan in this race. They want to create a stir, some momentum.
Yes.
And there have been a lot of other special elections over the last few months where Democrats have won.
And what happened, for instance, in Miami when Annette Taddeo won, a lot of other Democrats were watching that sort of as a bellwether. It was like, well, if she wins in that election, then we're going to file to run against this one and file to run against that one. So it does have somewhat of a domino effect, and it's picking up more and more candidates. So you're going to see some more, I would say, more competitive races as we go forward, because people are motivated on both sides. Mm-hmm. So
well,
it'll be interesting to watch.
What we're talking about here is a reaction to the Trump presidency, the spectacle that is, and Democrats are showing strength in areas that voted for Donald Trump by large margins. But backlashes are short-lived. I mean, they don't necessarily have legs. And I think the importance of a race like this one in Sarasota is that it's a House race. It's a state House race. But this is how the Democrats build a bench of candidates at the county commission level, judicial races, state House races, where you have candidates that can run for higher office or statewide office another 5, 10, 15 years down the road. And that might give the Democrats a lasting strength that they certainly don't have now.
But if this is historically a Republican district, Brendan, it would be a huge shot. It would be a huge clarion call for the Democrats to win this one.
It would, but again, it might not say much about the long-term prospects. Again, how much of this is just a reaction against the Trump presidency, and you have this energized Democratic base coming out voting in a district that they didn't vote in before?
Mm-hmm. And you'll see that play out when you go into the next general election. If the Democrat were to win this time, whether they can keep the seat or whether they get knocked out in the general election, a special election is entirely different than a general election, so it could be a whole different world come November.
Susan, are volunteers, are you seeing a lot of volunteers from around the state going to this Sarasota
Democrats
district?
Democrats from across Florida are making calls for Margaret Good. We did the same when Mayor Kreisman was running his reelection. The key excitement about this is that Democrats are making this competitive. April's exactly true. This is a historically Republican district. It was gerrymandered to carve out African-American voters when it was created. Donald Trump won it by 4.4%. There's a 12,000 vote Republican advantage in this district. And yet, just like April said, it's neck and neck. And that's a very exciting thing. We saw this last week in Missouri when a Democrat flipped a state seat in a district that Donald Trump won by 26 points. Mm-hmm. So that's exciting for Democrats. And sure, things ebb and flow back and forth and the pendulum swings, but this is a real opportunity for Democrats.
Okay. Well, this week, the Florida Education Association launched an online campaign blistering House Republicans' nearly 200-page omnibus education bill.
The bill is HB 7055. It aims to establish and fund a tax credit scholarship for students who say they are bullied in public schools. They would use that scholarship at private schools. It would also create a similar scholarship for third grade students who do not pass their state language arts tests. And it contains provisions that many state educators see as union busting.
It's an attack on Florida families. House Bill 7055 is another Tallahassee assault on our local public schools. Political insider Richard Corcoran has a plan to divert even more of our tax dollars to unaccountable private schools while slashing the pay of even our best teachers. His bully bill wastes more money on failed programs while our schools starve and our children suffer. It's time to drain the swamp. And we know just where to begin.
While the union is attacking HB 7055, the bill is also facing some opposition in the Senate, where even some conservative senators say it's being rushed through by the House.
Allison, let's start with fact-checking that ad. I know you fact-checked it at PolitiFact. Is that ad true?
So we fact-checked a specific line from that ad, that idea that Richard Corcoran has a plan to divert tax money to these unaccountable charter school or these unaccountable private schools, rather. And we ended up rating it half true. We found that there is some truth to that idea, but it really takes a lot of information and understanding of the subject to really get to the point they're trying to make. So this idea is from the Florida Education Association. They're arguing that any expansion of a tax credit program is really taking money away from public schools and diverting it to these unaccountable private schools. Experts say that diverting was literally the best word you could use in this case. As you can see on the screen, they actually said sends tax dollars to these private schools. That's not nearly as accurate, but the idea that these private schools are unaccountable, we also found some evidence to support that, but unaccountable almost goes too far because there are, of course, some laws that govern these private schools who receive vouchers. But for the most part, the idea that the legislature is diverting money away or to private schools definitely has some truth. But like I said, there was a lot of context and a lot of things I had to explain, I think, to ultimately arrive at the point they're trying to make.
All right, so there is some accountability measures for charter schools. They're not completely unaccountable.
Yeah, experts say that while there is some laws, they're very ineffective. And but there is some response from the legislatures this year to promote some bills that would actually require private schools to hire teachers with certifications or who have college degrees. So there definitely has been a response to that lack of oversight.
April, is there a case to be made that we need to have more tax credit scholarships, especially for kids in third grade that aren't doing well in reading, and also for kids that are bullied in schools?
I think that this is an ongoing thing that we've seen over the last several years with the legislatures, that they're supporting more and more scholarships for private schools. If we can't improve the quality and the education that children are getting in public schools, then giving them an opportunity to go to a private school, regardless of their, you know, family's ability to pay for that, I think that's probably a pretty good thing. The Florida Education Association is opposed to this bill. One of their biggest reasons is because it requires them to have a 50% membership of all teachers in the Florida Education Association. Well, there's apparently, what I read today, 180,000 some teachers in Florida. They already have 137,000. So unless they're losing members at a really rapid pace, I'm not sure why that's such a big concern for them. But the funding of children going to private schools, I think we're going to continue to see more and more of that as our education system is not keeping up.
Let's start with the issue of decertification of unions. April says there's not much to worry about because most teachers do belong to a union. The union says that this is an effort to decertify unions. What say you?
I say that's part of Speaker Corcoran's agenda, along with diverting more funding towards for-profit charter schools. We saw what happened in Wisconsin when a similar kind of measure was passed, and teachers' pay was reduced by over $12,000 on average. So as far as money being diverted to for-profit charter schools, 90% of our students are in true public education schools, and I take issue with the opportunity that we are going to give up on our public schools because a small percentage of students will be going to for-profit charter schools. And I will say 7055 is part two of last session's 7069. It's a continuation of the same agenda. And when we were told that all these for-profit charter schools were going to come in and save students, not one has since applied yet.
All right. So, wow. Brendan, this is a big bill. I think it's the bill that Richard Corcoran, the House Speaker, wants.
I've read every word of it.
So some on the Senate side, some Republicans say, wait a minute, you haven't taken this through committee or anything like this on our side. You're just rushing it through. So there's some objection on the Senate side. Would you expect the Senate and the House to come to some sort of agreement on this, or are they too far apart?
I think they probably will, because it's consistent with a long-running support for charter schools and private schools in the Republican-controlled controlled legislature, and the animus against public school unions, teacher unions, because they generally support Democratic people and causes. I understand those two things, and I think there is a place for private schools and parochial schools and charter schools. What I don't understand, especially from a Republican-controlled legislature, is doing it at the expense of public schools, because from a strictly hard-nosed business point of view, I can't think of a better way to discourage companies from relocating to Florida than having a weak public school system. Because generally, rank-and-file employees, to your point, Susan, they're not going to be able to afford to go to these private schools, even with a tax credit. So the vast majority are going to go to public schools. Mm-hmm. And if we have a reputation of having a poor system in this state, it's going to do nothing but discourage investment and relocation of big companies, which is Rick Scott's number one reason for being.
April, do you want to respond to anything you've heard here so far?
I have to agree that, a good education system is the number one economic driver in anything that we do. So I think that we've made, in Florida, a lot of headline in improving our public schools over the last, since Jeb Bush's, education initiatives, but we need to focus harder because we're still trailing way behind other states in this country.
Susan, would you agree that we've made progress since the Jeb Bush years based on Jeb's steps towards education reform?
Actually, what I see is continual attacks on the funding for public education. It was the major focus in last session. It's a major focus in this session. The fact that they're trying to paint it as an opportunity to allow students who are bullied to move to a for-profit school, that makes me wonder, why are we leaving a child who has performance issues in a school and moving the victim to another school? That makes no sense to me, right? I mean, that's like calling bullying at part of this bill is lipstick on a pig, right?
All right. So, April, would you say that does it reward the bullier and not the victim?
That may be, but I think that the bigger problem is we need to take a look at how we run our school systems. The amount of money that's spent on the administration in any of our school systems is ridiculous, and there's a lot of waste spending. We spend an enormous amount of money, and we don't get a lot for those dollars.
Okay. Well, Republican State Senator Dennis Baxley has proposed a bill that would ban free speech zones on state university and college campuses.
Under Baxley's bill, a university could be sued for up to $100,000 in damages if students or others willfully interfere with a campus speaker or with protesters. That would include distributing literature. A similar bill is being considered in the House. Baxley says he's trying to encourage more civil debate on campuses. The American Civil Liberties Union of Florida opposes the bill, saying it would have a chilling effect on free speech on campuses because of the provision that holds universities liable for damages. The ACLU is concerned that damages might be awarded just because students boo too loudly at a speaker with whom they disagree. The bill has already passed the Senate Education Committee.
So, Brendan, do we have a problem that needs to be fixed here in Florida?
Well, I've always thought that free speech zones were kind of silly. I mean, they had them during the 2012 Republican convention in Tampa here, right? Because it implies if you got a free speech zone, then that means all the areas outside that zone, there's no free speech,
right?
Which seems kind of...
The whole country's supposed to be a free speech zone,
America,
right?
To me.
Yeah.
As far as the provision in this that makes universities and colleges liable if a speaker is materially interfered with, pretty vague language there. That could mean just shouting them down could result in financial liability for the school. Seems like an invitation to fraud to me, or monkey wrenching, in which a conservative group could put a speaker forward at a predominantly liberal school, and then they could send in a couple shills or plants that will interfere with that, and bingo, you've got grounds for a lawsuit. So mm-hmm. I think this will be shot down in the courts before it even goes into effect.
All right, so you like part of the bill, but not the part that leaves the university liable.
I'll take A, but I'll, yeah.
All right. So, Alice, do we have a problem here in the state of Florida? I don't know if you fact-checked this, but do we have a problem in the state of Florida where controversial speakers are being barred or prevented from speaking on college campuses? Richard Spencer just spoke at the University of Florida in Gainesville. And
yeah, it's hard not to think of that event that was talked about a lot in the news. But I think it's been a really intense year for First Amendment discussions on campuses and universities. And while I can't speak to whether Florida has a specific problem, we've seen a lot of free speech bills across campuses from Wisconsin to California. So Florida is not the only state tackling this issue. And I really think that last year was a huge year for just First Amendment chatter. So I can't say for certain whether Florida has this problem, but it's definitely elsewhere we've seen it happen.
And is holding the university or college liable if students hand out literature or shout down the speaker? Is that part of the bills around the nation? Do you know?
Yeah, that's kind of the same thing. I don't know if it's as harsh as this one is with the specific amount, but definitely the same type of thing being followed in these other states.
Okay. Well, the horror stories about the federal government's handling of Hurricane Irma recovery keep coming.
This week, several news outlets reported the case of an Atlanta entrepreneur who was given a contract by FEMA to deliver 30 million meals to hungry people in Puerto Rico. Tiffany Brown's one-person company with no experience in disaster relief was given the $156 million contract to provide self-heating meals. Much of the island was and is without power. Brown's company delivered 50,000 meals, but there was a problem. The meals were not in self-heating pouches. Because of that, FEMA canceled the contract after 20 days. Lawmakers on House Oversight Committee in Washington have documents showing that Brown's company has had previous trouble delivering on smaller government contracts in the past.
So, April, this is not the only problem we've had with hurricane recovery in Puerto Rico. This is just one of many problems, but it's a pretty spectacular problem if you give a $156 million contract to a one-person company.
Yeah, that's a pretty lucrative contract for one person to drag in, I must say. Someone who doesn't have a kitchen to cook all that food in, right? But I think this is pervasive with FEMA. We've seen it repeatedly, and they had a problem with their electrical contractor in Puerto Rico. Now this comes out that they were having a problem with this type of a contractor. But this isn't new. FEMA always has these types of problems. Historically, we've seen it over and over again. And it goes back to same thing I said about the school board. We need to figure out how we're running these agencies and spending our tax dollars, because this is crazy that we're wasting that kind of money on unqualified contractors. There's plenty of people around that are qualified to do this type of work, and FEMA should have them at their fingertips because they should be prepared for disaster. Isn't that what they're for, is to come in and help during a disaster? They should be prepared for that, and they should know who the vendors are. But they're throwing money around to people that just can't provide any of the services. It's bad. We saw it in New Orleans.
Yeah. Susan, FEMA has problems and historically has had problems going back to Katrina in New Orleans.
Sure. We saw how George W. Bush handled Katrina with FEMA, and he got a lot of pushback on that. I think President Obama cleaned up a lot of that during his 8 years in office. I don't recall any instances of this nature. But now again, just like you referenced in the opening of this segment, one person for $156 million operation, what could possibly go wrong, right?
All right. Allison, have you fact-checked this? So does FEMA have an ongoing problem going back to Katrina? Have you guys looked at any of the statistics around FEMA?
We haven't fact-checked specific statistics about FEMA, but I think this is an ongoing issue. If you look back to Hurricane Katrina in 2005, we had a bipartisan investigation into FEMA, and they kind of concluded that FEMA wasn't prepared to do what it needed to do. And I think that just kind of speaks to the overall long history that FEMA's had. But we haven't fact-checked specifically any statistics about that.
I mean, George W. Bush was pilloried for congratulating Michael Brown during Katrina, saying, you know, Brownie, heck of a job you're doing. So the question is, should Donald Trump share some of the blame for the missteps of FEMA in this incident in Puerto Rico? I think that's an open question, but what we're stuck with is a huge bureaucracy that's absolutely necessary. There's no getting rid of FEMA because it's something that the country needs, and it's indispensable. So it's nice to say that, hey, it should be more efficient, it should be more thoughtful, and so on. eventually you've got to put the onus on the head of the agency and the president, the administration in charge. I mean, there's got to be eyeballs on this. The fact that these contracts were ever awarded in the first place to individuals working out of their kitchen just sounds like somebody's being very hands-off.
Yeah. Well, I wonder why the Red Cross or the U.S. military wasn't brought in, you know, either a giant nonprofit already existing or the U.S. military, which feeds millions of people every day.
Any of those organizations can handle it better than FEMA. Maybe we should just get rid of FEMA and rely on some other organizations to provide our disaster relief, because FEMA's obviously not doing a very good job.
All right. Anybody think we should get rid of FEMA besides April?
I just made the point that I don't think you ever could.
All right. Well, before we go, what other news story should we be paying attention to? Brendan, your other big story.
Well, on Friday, the Rays baseball team announced that they intend to locate a new baseball stadium in Ybor City. This was a press conference with Ken Hagen, with the Hillsborough County Commission, Mayor Bob Buckhorn, and others. A couple takeaways. Stu Sternberg with the Rays said that this is the only location they're looking at. So basically taking Tropicana Field site, Pinellas County, off the table. That's big news. Bob Buckhorn assured the audience that the financing for this would in no way resemble what happened with Raymond James Stadium, a community investment tax where virtually all the burden, all the debt was placed on taxpayers. Again, no specifics about how they were going to finance this. When Stu Sternberg was asked specifically by one of the reporters in attendance, how much money is the team willing to put up for a stadium that's estimated to cost at least $700 million, his answer was a good amount of money.
So he said he wasn't willing to put a number on
that. The team threw out the number $150 million earlier as kind of a ballpark thing.
But not at the press conference.
Which, again, out of $700 or $800 or $900 million isn't going to cut it. Mm-hmm. The other takeaway for me was somebody conspicuous by their absence, and that was Jeff Finnick, who is the owner of the Lightning, of course, and he has got the $3 billion Water Street Tampa project in the works. This is a few hundred yards from the site of this proposed new stadium. He was neither in attendance, he was not mentioned, the project was never mentioned, and this plays into a little bit of suspicion that this project is maybe not on track in the way that everybody has been led to believe. There's some talk in the business community that this $3 billion project, which is being financed in large part by Bill Gates' investment fund, Cascade Investment, they might be getting a little antsy about the projections associated with this. Can they fill that amount of office space and so on?
We'll have to pay attention to that story very closely. Allison, your other big story?
So House Speaker Richard Corcoran challenged Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum to a debate about sanctuary cities. As we know, Corcoran has been a big supporter of House Bill 9, which would effectively ban these sanctuary cities, and Gillum has again and again come out and really criticized Corcoran for his view on these cities. So I think that'll be a really interesting debate. It's queued up for Tuesday, so I definitely think having two different people with such different opinions, I mean, I know that's what a debate is, but I think in this case, they're both so passionate about opposite sides, I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens.
I think it's going to come up on next week's show, too. Susan, your other big story.
So why are federal judgeship appointments so important? So last Tuesday, U.S. District Judge Mark Walker issued a 43-page response to Rick Scott's clemency board, which he considered was acting arbitrarily and very slowly in the restoration of felon rights, right? This is a critical issue right now that will be on the ballot. The Judge Walker said that the question is whether such a system under partisan elected officials can pass constitutional muster. It does not. Mm-hmm. So Rick Scott will likely appeal that, but that's going to be a critical issue this year on our ballot.
All right. And April, you got the big story.
My big story. We have upcoming event that I want to share with you. Tampa Tiger Bay Club is putting on a Me Too event. It's a luncheon in conjunction with a large number of professional organizations throughout the city. It will be Wednesday the 24th or the 21st at noon, and you can get tickets at tampatigerbay.com. It is politics, media, and the workplace, and how the Me Too issue is affecting people in those areas and what we have to look forward to.
A big issue. All right. Well, thank you all for a great show. Thanks for watching Florida This Week. Your comments are always welcome. Please write us at ftw@wedu.org and follow us on Twitter and Facebook.
Well, that was Florida This Week from this past Friday night on WEDU-TV, the PBS station in Tampa. And my guests on that program were Susan McGrath, who is the chair of the Pinellas Democratic Party. Allison Graves is one of the PolitiFact reporters. Brendan McLaughlin is an independent journalist right now. He's spent years in local TV. And April Schiff is a Republican from Hillsborough County. And if you want to comment about anything you've heard here the last half hour, you can email us in the studio. Our address is dj@wmnf.org. I want to thank a bunch of people who've made contributions. Their names are coming in. These are people that have made contributions online to keep WMNF going. As you know, our phone system stopped working last Friday, and we were in the middle of a fund drive that had started on Thursday morning. So we're repairing the phone system. It should be up and running by 2 o'clock this afternoon, but we've been encouraging people to make contributions online to shorten the fund drive. Well, these are the folks that have made really nice contributions that have just come across the transom here. Pete Goldhammer from St. Petersburg has made a donation of $50. His favorite show is the Saturday Bluegrass Show. Mark Cracker from Sarasota made an $88.50 donation. His favorite show is the Saturday Bluegrass Show. And Dave Reinerson from St. Petersburg made a $50 contribution. His favorite show is the Acoustic Peace Club on Saturday mornings. And Gail Klein from Lutz made a $65 donation. And her favorite show is the Acoustic Peace Club. Chris Lunsford from St. Petersburg made a $100 contribution. And he likes Saturday Asylum. Here's somebody that likes talking animals. Jody likes talking animals. She made a $100 contribution. Thank you, Jody, for that. And Doug from Tampa made a $50 donation for 360 Degrees of Blues, which is on tonight at 8 o'clock with Harrison Nash. So, Doug, thanks for that nice contribution. All these people have made contributions. The word of those contributions just came across the transom here. And you can make your contribution to help keep WMNF going by going online to our secure website, WMNF.org, and make your contribution there. Even though we're not coming at you every 5 or 10 minutes asking for money to donate, we are in a low-key fund drive. It's going to kick into high gear today at 2 o'clock. Well, as you heard over the weekend, Israel launched heavy airstrikes in Syria on Saturday, saying it hit air defenses and Iranian targets. And the Syrian army claimed to have brought down an Israeli F-16 that crashed in northern Israel in a major escalation of tension. The Israeli military said early assessments indicate that the jet had been shot down by Syrian fire, but this was still unconfirmed. I'm reading from a Reuters report. It marked the most serious confrontation yet in Syria between Israel and Iranian and Iran-backed forces that have established a major foothold in the country while fighting in support of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in the civil war. Well, Israel's involvement in that conflict over there, knowing that the U.S. backs Israel and Saudi Arabia is also allied with Israel, and knowing that the Russians and the Iranians are propping up the Syrian government, has a whole lot of implications for war and peace in the world. So we're going to listen to an interview that was done on Democracy Now! Last Friday, an interview that we did not carry. It's with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who was recently in Sarasota, and I interviewed him on my radio show, on this radio show, Radioactivity, just about 10 days ago. But let's listen to the interview that Amy Goodman did with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, and he talks about Iran. And it's a really great interview, so listen up. This is an excerpt from Democracy Now! From last Friday that we did not play right here on WMNF in Tampa. And when you find yourself incapable of seeing... And by the way, you can make a contribution online right now. Just go to WMNF.org and make a contribution. And if you want your name read on the air, we promise, so we will read it on the air. If you want to remain anonymous, you can remain anonymous too. Here's Democracy Now! From last Friday, a segment that we didn't air.
Battle Hymn for an Army of Lovers by Chris Matthews. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to look at the growing threat of war against Iran. In recent weeks, senior members of the Trump administration have repeatedly tried to churn up U.S. support for a war against Iran, while President Trump has reiterated his threats to pull the U.S. out of the landmark 2015 Iran nuclear deal. Last month, President Trump issued a waiver to prevent the reimposition of U.S. sanctions against Iran, but warned he would not do so again unless the nuclear deal is renegotiated. The waiver must be reissued every 120 days to avoid the sanctions from kicking back in. His warning came after U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, spoke at the Anacostia Bowling Military Base in Washington, D.C., in front of
All right. Well, Democracy Now! Is recycling here. Let's see if we can get this to a play for us. This is Amy Goodman talking about heightened tensions between the U.S. and Iran. Well, the program wants to restart. We won't do that. We're going to go back and listen, try to pick up where we left off. As we listen to Democracy Now!, a segment from last Friday that we didn't get a chance to air. Let's see if we can pick it up here. And if not, we might just take a music break. We'll take a music break, and we'll be right back as we try to cue up this really interesting interview with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson.
Is an example of one of these attacks. These are the recovered pieces of a missile fired by Houthi militants from Yemen into Saudi Arabia. The missile's intended target was the civilian airport in Riyadh, through which tens of thousands of passengers travel each day. I repeat, the missile was used to attack an international civilian airport in a G20 country. Just imagine if this missile had been launched at Dulles Airport or JFK, or the airports in Paris, London, or Berlin. That's what we're talking about here. That's what Iran is actively supporting.
Weapons experts widely criticized Ambassador Haley's speech, saying the evidence was inconclusive and fell far short of proving her allegations that Iran had violated a UN Security Council resolution. But to our next guest, Haley's claims were not only inconclusive, they were also oddly reminiscent of the false claims about weapons of mass destruction the George W. Bush administration used to sell the public on the war with Iraq. Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson served as Chief of Staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell from 2002 to 2005, during which time he helped prepare Powell's infamous speech to the UN claiming Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. Powell's speech was given 15 years ago this week, February 5th, 2003.
One of the most worrisome things that emerges from the thick intelligence file we have on Iraq's biological weapons is the existence of mobile production facilities used to make biological agents. Let me take you inside that intelligence file and share with you what we know from eyewitness accounts. We have first-hand descriptions of biological weapons factories on wheels and on rails. The trucks and train cars are easily moved and are designed to evade detection by inspectors. In a matter of months, they can produce a quantity of biological poison equal to the entire amount that Iraq claimed to have produced in the years prior to the Gulf War.
That was then Secretary of State General Colin Powell speaking February 5, 2003 before the UN Security Council. Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, his chief of staff, has since renounced this speech, which he helped write. Well, his new op-ed for the New York Times is headlined, "I helped sell the false choice of war once. It's happening again." Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, welcome back to Democracy Now! Talk about how you felt at the time, how you came to understand the evidence that General Colin Powell, who himself said called this speech later a blot on his career, how you put this speech together and the echoes of it, what you hear today in Ambassador Haley's speech.
Amy, we put the speech together with arguably the entire U.S. intelligence community led by George Tenet, the director of Central Intelligence, literally at Powell's right hand all the time, 7 days, seven nights at Langley and then in New York before we presented. When I saw Nikki Haley give her presentation, certainly there was not the gravitas of a Powell, not the statesmanship of a Powell, not the popularity of a Powell. What I saw was a John Bolton, and remember, John Bolton was her predecessor in terms of being a neoconservative at the United Nations, representing the United States. I saw a very amateurish attempt, but nonetheless, these kinds of things, when they're made visual and the statements are made so dramatically, have an impact on the American people. I saw her doing essentially the same thing with regard to Iran that Powell had done, and I had done, and others with regard to Iraq. So it alarms me. I don't think the American people have a memory for these sorts of things. Gore Vidal called us the United States of amnesia with some reason. So we need to be reminded of how the intelligence was politicized, how it was cherry-picked, how we move towards a war that has been an absolute catastrophe for the region and even long-term for Israel's security and the United States, perhaps, with a deftness and with a fluidity that alarmed me then. It really alarms me now that we might be ready to repeat that process. And your previous speaker on North Korea, there's another target. This president has so many targets out there that he could avail himself of at almost any moment that we have to shudder at the prospects for war and destruction over the next 3 years of Donald Trump's term.
Can you talk about the pieces of metal she was talking about?
I can't imagine how anyone could haul some metal in front of the TV cameras and assert the way she did with the details she did, some of which was false, just flat false, and expect anyone with any expertise, at least, to believe it. Open parentheses, the American people don't necessarily have that expertise, close parentheses. Look at her statement about this could have been shot at Dulles or it could have been shot at Berlin. Had it been shot at Dulles or Berlin, it would have stopped well short. Somewhere in the Atlantic Ocean or even shorter. These missiles are not long-range missiles. These missiles are very inaccurate missiles. They have a CEP of miles. That means that unlike a U.S. nuclear weapon, which would hit within a 10-meter circle or less, it would hit within a mile or two circle. They don't know where it's going to hit when they shoot it. It's not very accurate, in other words. So the things that she was presenting there, she was presenting with a drama that even if what she was saying fundamentally was true, that the Houthis got it from Iran and shot it at Saudi Arabia, it simply was so exaggerated that one just looks at it and says, I can't believe that the United States is represented by that woman.
Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, it's very interesting that you have this moment now in U.S. history where the Republicans, some of them, are joining with President Trump in trying to discredit the intelligence agencies. And yet you go back to 2003 when you have a fierce criticism of the intelligence agencies, saying they were being used to politicize information, which oddly is what President Trump is saying in a very different context.
You would have a lot of sympathy if you asked me if I have some doubts about the U.S. intelligence agencies, all 17 of them now, definitely. Let me tell you what I've done over the last 11 or 12 years on two university campuses with really brilliant students in terms of enlightening myself, gaining new insights into what happened not only in 2002 and 3, but what's been happening ever since, and for that matter, what happened ever since Richard Nixon with regard to the intelligence communities. What happens is you get people like Tenet. You get people like John Brennan. You get people like John McLaughlin. You get people like Chris Mudd, for example, Phil Mudd, who was head of counterterrorism for George Tenet and who tried at the last minute to get me to put even more stuff into his presentation about the connections between Baghdad and Al-Qaeda. You get people like that who are at the top. That screens all the many dedicated, high moral, high character professionals down in the bowels of the DIA, the CIA, the NSA, and elsewhere. That screens their views, which are often accurate, I'd say probably 80% of the time, very accurate, from the decision makers. So what you get is you get people like Tenet and McLaughlin and Brennan who shape whatever they can to fit the policies that the president wishes to carry out. The intelligence, therefore, gets corrupted. So in that sense, I am still down on the, quote, U.S. intelligence community, unquote.
I mean, it's really interesting because a number of the people you mentioned from the past are the current commentators on television.
Yes. Yes. John McLaughlin. John McLaughlin lied to the Secretary of State of the United States on more than one occasion during the preparation for the 5 February 2003 UN Security Council.
I want to turn to President Trump speaking to the United Nations General Assembly in September.
The Iran deal was one of the worst and most one-sided transactions the United States has ever entered into. Frankly, that deal is an embarrassment to the United States, and I don't think you've heard the last of it, believe me. It is time for the entire world to join us in demanding that Iran's government end its pursuit of death and destruction. It is time for the regime to free all Americans and citizens of other nations that they have unjustly detained. And above all, Iran's government must stop supporting terrorists, begin serving its own people, and respect the sovereign rights of its neighbors.
Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, respond to President Trump and talk about the clock being put ever closer to midnight.
That agreement, the JCPOA, the nuclear agreement between the UN Security Council permanent members, Germany, Iran, that agreement is probably the most insidious and likely way to war with Iran. The Obama regime, in a very, very difficult diplomatic situation, achieved the best it could. That best is a nuclear agreement that keeps Iran from a nuclear weapon and gives us over a year of time, should they try to secretly break out of it, to inspect and find and to stop, even if we had to bomb. So it is an agreement unparalleled in regard to stopping Iran's search for, if it ever had the desire to, a nuclear weapon. If Trump undermines that, if this administration undermines that, then there is no, and they are moving fast to do that, there is no other alternative if you look at it. Now, my colleagues and some of my opponents in this will say, oh, no, that doesn't necessarily mean war. It certainly does if you continue this march towards Iran's unacceptability of Iran's having a nuclear weapon. Because then we will have intelligence telling us that Iran is... I know the Foundation for Defense of Democracy and others will never let this rest. We will have everyone telling us that Iran, whether they are or not, is going after a nuclear weapon once the agreement is abrogated. That means the only way you assure the American people in the international community, the region, Saudi Arabia, salivating for a war with Iran, with American lives at the front... That means the only way you stop Iran under those circumstances is to invade 500,000 soldiers and troops. You better have some allies, 10 years, $4 or $5 trillion. And at the end of that 10 years, it looks worse than Iraq did at the end of its 10. That's what you're looking at over the long haul if you say this agreement is no good and abrogate it. Because if it's still unacceptable that Iran not get a nuclear weapon, the only way that you assure that is by invasion. Bombing won't do it. All bombing will do is drive them underground. They'll develop a weapon. They'll work with the North Koreans and so forth. We know they have worked with the North Koreans in the past, and they will develop one. And then they'll be like Kim Jong-un. They'll present us with the fait accompli. Nuclear proliferation is a real threat right now, and I agree with the bulletin of the atomic scientist bulletin that the hands on the doomsday clock are now at two and a half minutes or so from midnight. We are more in danger of a nuclear exchange on the face of the earth than we were in probably any time since 1945, and that includes the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962 and the Berlin Crisis that more or less preceded it. This is a dangerous time, and we have a man in the White House who is a dangerous president.
Colonel Wilkerson, on Wednesday, Defense Secretary James Mattis defended a Pentagon request to develop new so-called low-yield nuclear weapons, telling reporters the U.S. needed a more complete range of nuclear options. And this comes as the Trump administration has unveiled its new nuclear weapons strategy, which involves spending at least $1.2 trillion to upgrade, they say, the U.S. nuclear arsenal. Your response?
Make that about $2 to $3, maybe even $4 trillion, because that's what the cost overruns will be, and that's what we'll spend over the next 10 to 15 years to do this, and we do not need it. Just look at some of the components of this. We're looking at a B-21 bomber for the Air Force, for example, that's going to be so expensive the Air Force won't even tell the Congress how much it's going to cost. We're looking at a nuclear-tipped cruise missile for that bomber, which negates the need for the bomber. It's redundant, but we're going to do it anyway. This is to assuage the military-industrial complex in America that deals with nuclear weapons. This is to spend lots of money and keep lots of nuclear scientists and others in their jobs. I understand that, but I don't condone this kind of money being spent. This is to respond to the Russians, whose military doctrine now includes using small-yield nuclear weapons should they be invaded by NATO. It's written in their doctrine. This is to further perturbate the situation with the Chinese, who are taking Mao Zedong's nuclear philosophy and throwing it out the window and thinking, oh, maybe we better build lots more nuclear weapons so we can ride out a first strike and retaliate. This is all because of the United States. It's all because of what's happening in the world post-Cold War that we all thought was going to be more peaceful and is turning out to be more catastrophically
dangerous.
Colonel
Wilkerson, Trump just tweeted, just signed bill. He's talking about the spending bill. Our military will now be stronger than ever before. We love and need our military and gave them everything and more. First time this has happened in a long time. Your last 10-second response.
Not the first time. Ronald Reagan did it, 82, 83, 84, and he did it on politicized intelligence about the Soviet Union. We knew it was falling apart at that time, but that didn't go along with his arms buildup. That's exactly what Trump is doing, and he's using the military to gain more votes.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson served as the chief of staff of the Secretary of State of Colin Powell from 2002 to 2005. That does it for our show. Very happy birthday.
Well, that was Amy Goodman's Democracy Now! From last Friday, a section of the program that we weren't able to play for you last Friday, but I wanted to play it for you today because of the increased tensions between Israel and Iran and the potential for a wider conflict involving the U.S. and Russia. Well, you're listening to Radioactivity on WMNF in Tampa, and you might have heard that our phone system here inside the building went down last Friday in the middle of our fundraising drive. And so we had to stop our fundraising drive last Friday at about 8:30 in the morning, and we're going to pick it up again this afternoon at 2 o'clock. Very unusual for us, something that we almost have never done. So we're hoping that you'll make a contribution right now, make it online, because if you make a contribution online right now, you'll be able to shorten that drive, and it won't go for 7 days or so. So please make your contribution online here at WMNF.org. That's the place to do it. It's a secure website. Now, a lot of local businesses, especially restaurants, have helped out during the fund drive. And it again, the fund drive begins at 2 o'clock this afternoon, but some local businesses have sent over some terrific food to power our hungry volunteers. Thanks to the Little Donut House, located at 4048 West Kennedy Boulevard in Tampa. They prepared 100 donuts for the volunteers who will be here soon taking your pledges. And thanks to Stephen and Katie for their continued support for WMNF. So thanks to the good folks at the Little Donut House. And also Starbucks Coffee, located at 8229 Park Edge Drive in Tampa. They have sent baristas, baristas there have sent over coffee to keep our volunteers powered up. And thanks to Arlene for arranging this and picking it up. And one more local restaurant to thank, Taste B&B International Cuisines has prepared bread pudding for the volunteers here taking pledges. Thanks to Sharifa and Theo Bennett for your continued support for WMNF. Thanks for that delicious bread pudding. So a lot of delicious food here at WMNF for our hungry volunteers. You can come down and volunteer, maybe partake in some of the food and answer phones. We're going to need some help today beginning at 2 o'clock as we try to raise $250,000 over 7 days. I think so far we've raised about $40,000. So we're going to end the fund drive as soon as we reach that magic $250,000 mark. So we've raised about $40,000 so far, I believe, and so we've got another $210,000 to raise beginning at 2 o'clock this afternoon. Sean Cannon is going to be up on the Midpoint program coming up next and playing some interesting highlights from that Pacifica thumb drive that we're offering, 1,350 hours of programming from the Pacifica Radio Network. It's an incredible collection, and you can have it for a $150 donation. This is WMNF in Tampa. Thanks to Frank Knox. He was our phone producer today, although he didn't have much work. Stay tuned for the latest news, and then Sean Cannon.